Nearly 2,000 people have died because of the earthquake and tsunami that hit Indonesia a few weeks ago. Thousands more have lost their homes. Here's survivor Mulis Ipol speaking to NPR's Julie McCarthy.
Dia memberikan saya mukjizat.
God gave me a miracle, he says. The rushing mud opened a way out. I saw a cable, tucked it under my arm, and the mud flow pulled me along.
Today, we talk to Illinois college students who are raising money for relief efforts. Plus, with less than a month until the midterm elections, we'll hear the latest sentiments of Illinois voters and round up the latest meetings between Governor Rauner and his challenger, J.B. Pritzker. Also, Bobby Hambrick started an Illinois company that makes parts for self-driving cars, and he says that future is right around the corner.
Everything has changed. The unique part of this industry right now is that it's moving forward at a pace unlike any other technology has been developed before.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's just 3 weeks before the November election, so coming up this hour, we'll ask how the confirmation process of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh may be influencing how people in Illinois are voting. And we'll hear about the latest round between Governor Bruce Rauner and his Democratic challenger, J.B. Pritzker. Also, we'll speak with one Illinois company that's hoping to be at the forefront of the self-driving car evolution. But first, on September 28th, a 7.5 magnitude earthquake hit one of Indonesia's largest islands. Shortly after, a tsunami also hit the provincial capital of Palu in the central part of the country. Both of these devastating natural disasters and their after effects have left at least 2,000 people declared dead. Officials say as many as 5,000 more might still be missing. That's in part because of mud flows that have buried hundreds of houses. Here across Illinois, Indonesian students have been raising money to help with relief efforts back home. This may be in part because of the number of students with connections to the international world. At the University of Illinois, 1 in 4 students are international, many of them from Asia. Indonesian students are actually the fifth largest international student group on the Urbana campus. Tajer is a sophomore at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's vice president of Permias Chicago. That's an Indonesian student group. Minaj Hassan is a spokesperson with Islamic Relief USA. He's on the line from Alexandria, Virginia. Minaj, Nate, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. I'm
great. Thank you for having me.
And also with us from Indonesia is Yohanes Suleman. He's a lecturer at the School of Government at General Ahmad Yani University. Yohanes, welcome. Thank you for being here with us. I appreciate it. I know it's a late night where you are right now, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Nate, before we get to some of the fundraising, I know you're from just outside of Jakarta, so quite a far away from where the area where the earthquake hit. But I wanted to ask if you have any friends who have been affected?
I'm from Jakarta, Indonesia, so I don't have family members or friends in Palu, Central Sulawesi, although some of my friends I'm going to college with here in Chicago have relatives in Palu, so yeah.
It must be hard to see this happening from so far away.
Yeah, it's actually the first disaster that I haven't been in Indonesia for, so yeah.
What is that like to be? I imagine it's really hard because then you're also looking at international news coverage and you're probably used to just seeing the way everyone in your own country is reporting on everything that's happening.
Definitely, yeah. I haven't had access to Indonesian media TV here in Chicago, but I've been trying to keep up with the news from other news sources, from international news sources. I'm also hearing from my family in Indonesia about how it's going.
Yohanes, can you help us understand the regions where the earthquake and the tsunami hit, particularly Palu in that area?
Well, the tsunami happened right on the eastern part of Indonesia, which is quite far from where I am currently. And basically, if we think where I am is at Los Angeles, the tsunami and all this stuff happened actually around Sica Guare. So it's actually pretty far from the central area of Indonesia, actually. But you know, but of course, everybody, but of course, everybody, lots of people have families there, lots of people have relatives there, so the nation are kind of mobilized over this tragedy.
And I wonder, do you have family in the affected area or friends as well?
Well, fortunately, no, I don't have any family, although I do have some friends, but fortunately, they are all fast doing fine, although they are still trying to cope up with tragedy.
And is the affected area that's central Sulawesi, is that a rural area? Is it urban? What can you tell us about it?
Well, it happened in a kind of a decently sized town, city. It is around like 400,000 population, so it is quite urban, although not as heavily urbanized as in Java, which is like more than 50% of the population resided. So, Sulawesi is not a very very crowded area, but especially the biggest city in Sulawesi is actually Makassar, which is pretty far south, and also Manado, which is far north from Palu. So size-wise, I think it is like partly urban, partly rural. But it happened right in the urban area of Palu, basically.
We've also got Minhaj Hassan with us from Virginia with Islamic Relief USA. Minhaj, it might be easy to forget that Indonesia is not just the fourth largest country in the world, but also has the largest Muslim population in the world. How much staff does Islamic Relief USA have on the ground in Indonesia, and particularly now maybe you've moved to the affected area?
Yes, we have about 30 members on the ground, about several staff members, comprised of staff and volunteers. I spoke to one earlier yesterday, and they were on their way to Palu, and they said, and they're helping provide the emergency needs of the residents there, food, water. We have a generator set up there so people could even charge their cell phones if need be. And so right now our focus is on emergency life-saving assistance to make sure they have the food, the medical assistance, the blankets. So between all of us, there's about 30 staff and volunteers there. And we've also partnered with some of the local organizations there to help supplement our efforts.
And I know it's been a couple of weeks, but it sounds like the relief efforts are really focused on still immediate life-saving stuff, as you said, in terms of, I guess, shelter, medical needs. Is that what the focus is right now?
Yes, our emergency response consists of distributing 1,000 cartons of drinking water, 500 blankets, 500 tarpaulins, and 500 dry food packages, which will go to about 500 families, which amounts to about 2,000 people, because a family is roughly 4 people. And we have distributed, or we are in the process of distributing that. One of the big obstacles from what our people on the ground have said is that there's a lot of impassable roads. Either roads are closed or they're destroyed, or bridges have been destroyed because of the tsunami and the earthquake. So that has created some additional challenges and obstacles. But we're doing the best we can, as well as other aid agencies on the ground.
Johannes, to Minhaj's point, is that one of the biggest problems right now? Just the idea of roads and infrastructure and being able to get to people, Johannes?
Yes, basically the airport the runway on the airport was completely destroyed, although they managed to fix it in the. A few days after the tsunami, and also the roads going there from Manado and also from other area was basically blocked, and there are also a lot of thieves. People are using the opportunity to steal the aids from the government trucks. And so, for the first couple of days, I mean, it's kind of chaotic actually. So I mean, but. But fortunately, the government has done a pretty good job in actually trying to move forward, trying to reestablish the connection. I'm not going to say that they have been doing it like all okay, like it's perfect, but it is. But based on what's going on there, I think it is pretty adequate.
And when you talk about the job that the government is doing, Johannes, what about in terms of international aid? Do you feel like, is the government of Indonesia accepting foreign aid? How are they doing on that front?
The government is always accepting foreign aid, but what they don't accept are kind of surprising is actually foreign workers that coming foreign aid workers. You know, the government is actually telling the aid workers that we accept all your aid, but not the workers, because we want to deal with it ourselves. I mean,
right.
There's always this sense of nationalism of the government, which is kind of in some cases kind of annoying, because the aid workers usually really knows better what they are doing.
Right, and especially I would think for expertise, right, for engineers or for trying to, especially if people are, when we're thinking about mudslides and things like that. Minhaj, does that change for Islamic Relief USA? I imagine that's why it's important for you to be partnering with agencies that are in Indonesia, that are, I imagine, are Indonesian nonprofits or other groups, as opposed to maybe NGOs?
Yes, we always try to partner with local organizations in the respective countries, only because, just like you said, they're most familiar with the surroundings, with the culture, with the situation on the ground. So we're certainly there to help and supplement and enhance the relief effort and response. So yeah, we always put a premium on that, working with local organizations.
That's Minhaj Hassan with Islamic Relief USA. We're also speaking to Nay Tager, who's a sophomore at UIC. Nay, I mentioned that you're working with one of the student organizations in Chicago, Permias Chicago, to provide relief. What are you guys trying to do?
So I'm actually also part of the national organization for Permias, and we are currently raising funds, and we're going to channel all the funds in order to help the victims in Palu. And we're currently we have raised about $12,000 so far, which we are going to, because Permias Chicago is also an official recognized NGO in Indonesia. We're hoping we can use what we have as an organization, and we can channel all the funds from all the students, Indonesian students in Chicago and also in all of America, to help the victims of disaster in Palu.
And so right now, Nay, are you primarily collecting you're collecting money, I presume, right, to be distributed?
Yes, we have a GoFundMe page, and we're also collecting money from each chapter of Permias as well, and we're going to channel that fund to Palu.
And so I know there's a pretty big chapter on the Urbana campus. There's a chapter at the UIC, where you are. Are the chapters doing specific events around this as well, or is it more of a social media effort?
For Chicago, since we are a smaller chapter, we're only doing a social media effort. However, in larger chapters, such as in Philadelphia, and I know in other chapters, they are currently doing events like food fundraising events and other gatherings in order to raise funds. But for Chicago in particular, we're only doing social media since we are a smaller chapter.
Minhaj, I wanted to ask you about Islamic Relief USA. Do you work with mosques across the country? I wonder how mosques across the country in Illinois may also be trying to help with relief efforts.
We do work with mosques across the country on various projects and initiatives. And from what I understand, yes, there have been some mosques who have stepped up and are raising awareness and collecting donations for the Indonesian relief effort. But yeah, from what we understand, there have been several mosques that have stepped up. There is one that has raised awareness for it. So.
Right. And obviously, of course, anyone can donate to Islamic Relief USA on your website. Minhaj, can
Correct.
I just ask you what people should know as a reminder just about giving to organizations that are helping with disaster relief? This is always a good time for people to kind of remember to do some due diligence about the organizations they're giving money to.
Right. That's a good question. Yes. And that is the unfortunate reality. Sometimes when disasters hit, there are some organizations that unfortunately are compliant with the laws. But Islamic Relief USA has been around for 25 years, and we have a stellar reputation. We've been rated highly by Charity Navigator and all the other charity groups out there. But what I want to say to the to our prospective donors is the best thing you can do is to donate cash. I know a lot of people have good intentions that they want to donate physical items.
Things like blankets, right.
And water and all that. Unfortunately, because of the logistics and the cost of shipping it, it's just prohibitive. So what we really encourage our donors to do, the best way to help is to simply go on our website and to donate there. And we did launch an emergency appeal to alert our donor base through our website, through emails, through social media platforms to raise attention on this. And so far the reaction has been good, but obviously with a disaster of this magnitude, it's never enough. So we encourage people to continually donate to this cause.
Nay, I also wonder, as Minhaj is talking about all of this, there's been so much other news going on, particularly in the U.S. Do you feel like all of the news, for example, in Washington with like the Supreme Court confirmation, do you feel like that's overshadowed? Are you worried that people have not seen what's happened in your home country and people are maybe missing that story?
I actually feel like this is actually the first disaster in Indonesia for which I'm not in Indonesia. And looking at it from the global perspective, from what the international news outlets are saying, I personally feel like we're getting a lot of coverage in terms of the Palu earthquake. However, I do know that for the U.S. particularly, we have a lot of political things going on that might be more central in their news. However, I feel like it's always like that with certain national news outlets. So we're just trying to get the word out there, even though I feel like we already have media coverage.
That's Nay Tager, a sophomore at UIC. We will have at our website, we will tweet out links. Sorry about that. We'll tweet out links to Nay's fundraising as well as for Islamic Relief USA with Minhaj Hassan. I want to thank Johannes Suleman as well for joining us from Indonesia. All of you, thank you. Take care.
Support comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Professor James Anderson, Citizenship, Immigration, and National Identity, Civic Education on the Sesquicentennial Anniversary of the 14th Amendment, Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The midterm elections are in just 3 weeks here in Illinois. Voters will also be choosing our next governor. And we're deep into having those two candidates, J.B. Pritzker and Bruce Rauner, meeting on the regular this morning. They faced off in a Sun-Times meeting in a contentious debate. They will see each other again later this week in Quincy, the only televised debate that's happening outside of Chicago, by the way. That's on Thursday. The Paul Simon Public Policy Institute also just released some fall polls, which provide an interesting look at the role President Trump and his administration and other events in Washington may influence Illinois voters. Brian Mackey is with us from Springfield, where he's a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. Also joining us on the line from the Capitol is Mark Maxwell, who's the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA3. Brian, Mark, welcome back to the 21st, guys. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Nyla.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start, you guys, with J.B. Pritzker and Governor Rauner this morning in front of the Sun-Times editorial board, which is kind of like a debate. It was we were watching the stream this morning from our 21st office, and we pulled a little bit of it. Let's take a listen.
I'm fighting for more manufacturing jobs, and those jobs can become union jobs, and I want more union jobs in Illinois.
That is just hogwash. The governor has been fighting against unions and trying to destroy unions from day one of his governorship. He brought with him this Koch brothers right-wing network agenda that says lower wages and lower workplace safety.
Cheating on your taxes and raising taxes on union workers will not help union
workers. More desperation from the governor. Look, you wanted to lower people's wages in the state of Illinois because you thought that having a low-wage state would create jobs. You've been bad-mouthing the state since day one of your administration. That is why people don't want to move to the state.
Okay, a lot of hogwash and baloney was probably what most of you people heard from that exchange between J.B. Pritzker and Governor Rauner. Mark, I wanted to ask you about one thing Governor Rauner said, which is that he said he supports having union jobs in the state of Illinois and something he's always supported.
Well, this is an interesting internal struggle in the Rauner administration in his first term, because he's had a number of different advisors giving him different points of input there. John Tillman and the Illinois Policy Institute, which had a very prominent presence in the governor's office last summer, might have fallen in step with that criticism J.B. Pritzker had. But Congressman Rodney Davis, who enjoys the support of many labor unions in the central Illinois area, advised Governor Browner after he came into office, you know, tone it down on the trade union talk, the right to workshop. Just go after the public sector unions, the government unions. And so he's had different points of input from different conservative groups. And the governor has softened his language in public and said, look, I like trade unions. I like public union shops. I want those to, you know, be competitive. And he does support right to work. And he wants to see that happen at the local level. But he has adamantly denied opposing the trade unions and the working unions. He just has a hang up with government unions, if you take him at his word. There are other people, though, for instance, with Local 150 operating engineers, said to me in a phone call just last week, never trust a guy who says they like you, but they're trying to take down your best friend.
So Brian, yeah, and to that point,
in the unions.
Yeah, Marco, thanks for that. Brian, I wonder, do you think that voters are going to understand that distinction or that nuance that Mark is explaining there between public sector unions versus private sector unions?
Well, to the extent voters actually care about it, I mean, union membership is at a modern low. I mean, since the union movement really started rising up the better part of a century ago, for the past several decades, it's been declining. And that story is true in Illinois. It's, as you know, not quite as bad as in Illinois. And if you're if you're somebody who favors union membership, it hasn't declined as much as in some parts of the South, but it's declined here. But Rauner's, you know, there was an exit poll after the last election, he came away with about 40% of union households in that election, if that, you know, exit poll is accurate. This time, there was a recent poll, union households were, it was in the 20s that were supporting him. But for a lot of union members, maybe guns, maybe there are other issues, hunting. There are other issues that are salient to people beyond their pocketbook, particularly until they feel threatened. And, you know, this is the distinction Mark was talking about a moment ago about trade unions versus government public sector unions. This is something that was straight out of the Scott Walker playbook in Wisconsin. He had great support from trade unions, operating engineers, carpenters, plumbers, those sorts of people, and, you know, really focused his early attacks on teachers' unions, on organizations that represent state workers. But then, eventually, he did get around to pushing right to work for the entire state. And I think with Governor Rauner, you know, what he says, I'm not anti-union, baloney, he uses those phrases. I think, you know, as Mark pointed out, you can just look at what he does. And he has proposed these local right-to-work zones. He says, you know, if a local area, county, or a municipality wants to make themselves, an open shop, then they should be able to do that. And he backed and was pushed out of, but gave rhetorical support to this big lawsuit that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court this summer and will have a significant effect on public sector unions' ability to raise money, not just in Illinois, but across the country.
Governor Rauner was at the Supreme Court for that. Mark, I wanted to ask you about the tone. I played a little bit of that back and forth, so everyone, it was actually kind of, at a certain point, you can't even understand what anyone's saying because they're just kind of shouting each other out. Is that basically how most of the debates have gone?
Well, I think they've ratcheted up the intensity, or the tone has spiraled farther down into the gutter. At the second debate, we saw it reach a new level when essentially both candidates pointed at the other and said they should be a criminal or they are a criminal. That's alarming. How many elections do you have where you're calling the other guy an actual criminal and they're serious? They're not just joking. They've made it very clear they don't harbor a lot of goodwill toward the person they're trying to take down.
And so do we expect more for the same for Brian, for the only televised debate that's happening outside of Chicago in Quincy this Thursday?
You've got to imagine. I mean, the Pritzker camp kind of managed to exert their will on this debate cycle. We've seen reporting that the Team Rauner wanted a lot more debates. They wanted debates in other locations. But Pritzker, way back in May, said, here's the three debates we're doing. And in terms of televised debates, that's been it. And the downstate debate, rather than being in the largest city of Peoria or the state capital of Springfield or the most populous area downstate of Metro East, you know, which is the Illinois side of St. Louis, it's going to be in Quincy, which is a relatively small town, but it's notable in from a news standpoint for one thing. That's where the veterans home is, where more than a dozen veterans have died from Legionella bacteria, Legionnaire's disease. And the Rauner administration has repeatedly said that we've done every, you know, we did everything we could. We did all the right things. But a series of reports by one of our fellow public radio stations, WBEZ, some reporters there, Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold, have exposed that the administration was at times concerned about the messaging and the appearances of this. And there are just there are questions. And now there's the Attorney General's office has even opened a very unusual seeming, but a criminal investigation into whether there was sort of, I guess, criminal negligence in their handling of that. So
to be clear, that's State Attorney General Lisa Madigan, mm-hmm. a Democrat, has opened a criminal investigation into Governor Bruce Rauner.
Yeah, which is not generally something the Attorney General does, nor even if they even if she would, it's even more rare that they would comment on it. Right. So there are definitely the Republicans are raising questions and asserting that this is a politically motivated investigation. Of course, Madigan denies that. But the long story short, if that's possible, is that this debate is going to be in Quincy, which is very much where Mr. Pritzker would like to shine a spotlight on Governor Rauner's track record in office.
I wanted to ask you all about how events in Washington might be influencing Illinois voters. Specifically, let's start with the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, which has been a deeply divisive, brutal process for the country after allegations of sexual assault were made against him. And we've been hearing a lot about that over the past week. And in fact, just recently, some Illinois Democratic women started a new website here called womenarethebluewave.com. Mark, I just wanted to ask you, before we get to some of the Paul Simon public policy polling on this, what's your sense of, just from talking to folks in Springfield, how you think the events of Washington in the past week may have energized either both Republicans or Democrats, even just when we're thinking about the Springfield area?
Sure. Well, someone who's, you know, watched the Washington news cycle, it's you can look at the last week, but the big question is, will the last week still be in voters' minds in 4 weeks? Because who knows what news stories are yet to come in the next 4 weeks. But when you do look in the Kavanaugh hearings, as you mentioned, CNN, if I can cite a poll they put out just yesterday, showed that you have to look far and wide to find anybody who's really pleased with the way the confirmation process went down. And most Americans were unhappy with Republicans for the way they limited the scope of the FBI investigation into Brett Kavanaugh. But even a greater share of Americans were unhappy with Democrats for the way they sort of dropped the allegations at the 11th hour. And so there's just a lot of – I think the question here is how many voters will be turned off and just not show up at all compared to how many will be turned on and excited to come out and vote maybe in opposition or with the resistance, that blue wave we've heard. So I think that's really the interesting thing to look at there.
And the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute does a lot of polling for us here in Illinois, Brian. One of them recently did look at sexual harassment. And it, basically, the survey said 60% of the people surveyed said that those accused of talking about whether those accused of sexual harassment are more likely to be held accountable and whether or not they would be consider voting for a candidate who's been accused of sexual harassment. I wonder if you can give us a little more sense of that poll, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, this is interestingly breaks down along party lines. It's important to note, though, that this poll was mm-hmm. done as the second round of Kavanaugh hearings were taking place. It was started on a Monday. The polling ended on a Saturday. That hearing was on a Thursday. So this issue perhaps had not really burst through the national consciousness, you know, to the point where Saturday Night Live was satirizing it until midway through this poll. So it's not a perfect example. And again, Illinois is not the country. But I think what we are seeing is that, you know, when this issue, like so much else, when it becomes a partisan issue, that is, when it becomes you know, something that's attached to one tribe and not the other tribe, then you tend to stick with your tribe. And so I think what we saw there is, you know, just a continuation of what we've seen elsewhere in other political issues, be it climate change or the state budget or anything else. Something else, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but one of the other interesting things in about this recent Simon poll that also has to do with the potentially has to do with the Kavanaugh hearings is the enthusiasm gap, as it's described.
And yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, so there's a question they ask and in the poll, and it says, thinking about the upcoming elections, are you more enthusiastic than usual about voting or less enthusiastic?
But that question was asked 2 weeks ago, right, Brian?
Asked 2 weeks ago, again, as the Kavanaugh hearings were
going
on.
Things have changed a lot even in the past 4 days, right?
They have. But so that question then, so at least as of 2 weeks ago, and polls are just a snapshot in time, but that question showed that 65% of Democrats were more enthusiastic than usual, whereas only 54% of Republicans were more enthusiastic. And what I think is really interesting is when you compare that to 4 years ago, when Governor Rauner won office. In that election, only 31% of Democrats said they were more enthusiastic about getting out to vote for then-incumbent Governor Pat Quinn, and 49% of Republicans. So both sides are more enthusiastic, but for Republicans, it's only gone up by 5 percentage points. Democrats have doubled basically their enthusiasm heading into this election in Illinois, at least. Now, there was some subsequent polling that NPR had done of the Monday after the Kavanaugh hearings that showed that nationwide Republicans were getting more excited and that gap was narrowing to the point where it was basically wiped out nationally for that particular poll, for that snapshot. But in Illinois, there was a much bigger gap to begin with.
Brian, I want to just ask you one quick question about the polls. You've been careful to emphasize, which I think is important, that polling is a snapshot in time. But the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute polls, they're one of the few organizations that are really polling Illinois voters, right?
Publishing it. I mean, the campaigns are doing it relentlessly. They're just very secretive.
Well, then
about
I should say
it.
A nonpartisan group that's polling,
right,
correct? Because this is so.
There are a few others, but this is one of the ones that I particularly like because it's longitudinal. You can go back and look over time and see how attitudes have or have not shifted. But yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. As we think about attitude shifting, Mark, I wanted to ask you about the 13th Congressional District. You recently reported on a poll that found Republican incumbent Rodney Davis leading Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan challenger by just 1 percentage point, which is a much slimmer margin than a month ago. What's the latest on this race?
Well, I should note that that's one of those partisan polls you were just saying.
So we have to look at the source of the poll. That's important, too.
Right. And the Davis campaign said, well, if their polling is as accurate as their advertisements, then I wouldn't be too concerned. So a little layer of snark there in the race. But the same polling firm, which does pride itself on conducting actual data and reporting it to the campaigns, reported just a month prior that she was trailing by 5 points. So even if their poll is skewed a little in favor of their party, it does appear to show a tightening race. And I would point out that the Davis campaign hasn't really provided any data to refute that. So I think they understand that this race could be tight. And you also can look at, in the absence of other polls, you can look at national money. When national money floods into a congressional race at a lot higher rate than it does in other places, that's a pretty good idea that the people who have the data are interested in that being a close race, and they believe it is a close race. And that is happening here. We're seeing a lot of national money flood into the Illinois 13th Congressional
District. Interesting. That's Mark Maxwell, WCIA Capital Bureau Chief. I want to thank Brian Mackey with NPR Illinois. For those of you who are in the 13th Congressional District, we know a lot of our listening audience is. We have a way we would like you to be involved. Next week, I'm moderating a debate between Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan and Rodney Davis. And part of that is taking questions from you all. So we'd love to hear what questions you want to ask them. If you go to our website, there's a form there for you to submit questions. You can write them out. You can leave us a voicemail. You can even record a video. The voicemail number is our always number, 217-300-2121. If you want to leave us a voicemail, we'll tweet out that link as well. We really want to hear your questions because we will pose them. I will pose them to the candidates. And if you happen to be in the Urbana area, Brian and I will tonight be at a gathering at Riggs Beer Company for the latest Illinois Newsroom News and Brews. We're going to be talking about the election. Bring your questions and a chance to go through the entire ballot. That's going to be at 6 o'clock. Brian, Mark, thanks for being with me.
Good to talk to you, Nyla.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you think about automated parts or cutting-edge technology, how often do you think of Central Illinois? Maybe you do if you heard our episode from Research Park in Urbana a few weeks ago. Central Illinois is also home to a company called Autonomous Stuff. They're based in Morton, and they're hoping to help lead the way as self-driving cars become more and more common. Especially as it's Illinois Manufacturing Month, we wanted to spotlight some Illinois manufacturers. The founder and CEO of Autonomous Stuff, Bobby Hambrick, was in Urbana last week, and I had a chance to sit down with him. I started by asking him to explain in simple terms what his company does.
Yeah, so it's actually very simple, even for the customers that we have all throughout the world. Our main mission for the company is to enable our customers and the industry towards autonomous driving. So we provide products, engineering services, and software to help jumpstart our customers towards developing autonomous driving.
And do you work with just autonomous driving, or do you work with other automated products where you supply the parts for those as well?
Yeah, automated driving is probably the most famous one and the most publicly recognized application that we work on. But essentially anything that requires automation for automating driving of any type of platform, whether it be agriculture or mining or automotive, is a business that we're into.
And how did you end up in this business?
Well, who doesn't want to make robots for a living? So for one, it's a really cool industry to be in. We're developing technology that doesn't exist, and it's going to change the future of the way humans get from point to point. So for one, it makes a huge impact in the world. Of course I want to support something like that. But it is also, it's a good business. I mean, there's lots of need for companies that are providing some type of technology or some value to autonomous driving. So there's good business to be had.
And when we're thinking about automated driving, that's also something that people think is really cool, but then is also sometimes a little controversial, or people are worried about it. What do you say to people who think that this might be a dangerous thing?
I bring up a couple of things. So I get questions like this all the time. When can you buy an autonomous driving car? Do you think it's safe? When can I buy one? When can I put my kids in autonomous driving Uber? All these questions come up, and I try to relate it to something that we just naturally do. And one of those applications is cruise control. So today you get into a car, you push your cruise control button, and unless you have adaptive cruise control, which is something kind of new, that car would drive you into a brick wall, right? And so it's really a dumb technology that's not safe, but we adapt it because it adds some value to our life by making it more convenient to drive longer distances. So it's natural for human beings to take on automated driving, just like it was natural to put cell phones in our pocket, just like it was natural to go from the horse to the buggy or to the Model T.
But I do think that's another step, right? Because there are a lot of questions, or there's a lot of knowledge, I guess, that's required if we think about, and I guess maybe the knowledge is really harder if you're mixing autonomous cars with drivers. Like if every car was autonomous, it might actually be easier, right, to kind of figure out how they would interact. What kind of, when we're thinking about automotive technology and the intelligence side of it, is that work that you guys do?
Yeah, we do some of that work ourselves, but we also enable others to do that work. And that's really the mission of our company, is we provide all those products and software and integrate all this stuff onto an automated driving research car. And then we hand it over to our customers. And you can think of them as like application developers. And we're handing them the smartphone on wheels. And they're building some app for a mobility service of some type.
And so I think when we think about that, I think people think about manufacturing or other technology in Illinois and they think about automotive supplies. Like, we've had a long history in this part of the country of being automotive suppliers for traditional cars. Would you put yourself in the same category now just for autonomous cars?
It's very similar. Yeah. So for the researchers in the world that want to build automated driving software, we are the ones providing them the hardware and the platforms to do that. So in some ways it's the same, but it's more for research currently than it is for as opposed to production.
And when we're thinking about the people and the companies that are doing this technology, do you see most of your competitors as being American or in other parts of the world?
This is an initiative that's happening all over the world. So the reinvention of the way that humans transport around is not just a United States thing or North America thing. There's a lot of research going on all throughout Asia, especially China and Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. This has been happening. This research has been happening all over the world for decades.
And you guys have been around since about 2010, am I
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, I founded the company in 2010.
And what has changed when you started in 2010, I wonder what you're doing differently now than you were 8 years ago.
Everything has changed. And that's the unique part of this industry right now is that it's moving forward at a pace unlike any other technology has been developed before. In 2010, there were only a handful of customers in the world that really cared about automated driving. Most of them were military or agriculture or mining and a few automotive guys. So let's say there were 100 customers in the world in 2010, and now we have thousands of customers today. So the technology has advanced very, very rapidly.
And so you're from Morton, which is really, I think people know more for being the pumpkin capital mm-hmm. of the world than for engineering or technology. How did you first get involved in engineering and technology?
I think just an interest in robotics in general. And I also have an interest in finding a business that would be successful. And so the combination of robotics and my focus towards business, it was a natural fit. And the fact that I'm in Morton is just because I was born and raised in central Illinois. I was born in the hospital in Peoria, raised up in East Peoria, founded the company in Morton. And I enjoy lots of pumpkin goodies at this time of year.
Yeah, this is the right time of year to be asking to have you here, right? But when we're thinking about the idea of being in central Illinois, I wonder what your thoughts are when we're thinking about, first of all, just the challenges of operating a business anywhere in Illinois, but then also being outside of Chicago. Because I think when we think about manufacturing or technology, this is a conversation I often have with entrepreneurs outside of Chicago. Is it harder? Is there better access to capital, for example? Does it matter where you are these days when we're thinking about a company where you're in robotics? I don't know how much capital investments are an important part of your business. Is that something that's just as easy to do because you're not on the West Coast?
I would say that there are trade-offs. That doesn't matter where you found your company. There's always going to be a trade-off. If we're talking about a startup that needs capital to start up, I would say that would be a restriction if you're trying to do it in central Illinois than compared to Silicon Valley. In my case, I bootstrapped the company from ground zero, and we have been profitable every single month since we founded the company. So I didn't need that ingest of large capital from VCs or something. So that wasn't a restriction for me. What was important for me is a high quality of life, to get access to good, hardworking, loyal people who wanted to grow and create a career out of their job, not just passing through developing technology. And so that has worked out great for me. I've had plenty of access to engineering resources and have hired some amazing loyal people that have helped me grow the company. So there are trade-offs. You know, those things you don't get when you're in Silicon Valley. You get a lot of money and you get talent, but you don't get the loyalty. And people don't stick around for the end result.
And when you're thinking about talent, do you feel like I'm talking to you here on the University of Illinois campus. Obviously, there are people who come from all over the country mm-hmm. to recruit U of I grads, particularly when we're talking about your field in particular. Do you feel like we are creating a good enough labor force to handle these modern and soon to be future demands of things like autonomous driving? And are we creating enough engineers in this country to do that?
No, the demand for engineers is unlike ever before. So there are definitely not enough engineers in this world. And thankfully, the U of I is a great resource for that. I think it's a hidden secret within Illinois that companies are starting to recognize as one of the leaders in providing engineers for this industry. But currently, these kinds of engineers that know something about automated driving and the technology behind that are very highly sought after.
And do you have a hard time finding those people?
As of right now, I haven't had that limitation, but I also haven't had to scale up thousands of engineers at one time in a short period of time. If I had to do that, there would be some limitation, but that's not just exclusive to me. I mean, every company in the world that is focusing on automated driving is having a tough time finding engineers.
And so I wonder, when we're thinking about, you've talked about Central Illinois, it's really important, it seems like, to you to keep your company here. I wonder what you think the economic benefits are to the region. I'm thinking about other companies like Rivian in Bloomington that is also in this sector, in the manufacturing space. Do you feel like, I don't know how many companies you think there needs to be to have a cluster, but do you see this could eventually be something that could be a regional economic benefit, this industry for Central Illinois, kind of the whole autonomous driving?
Absolutely. We have an opportunity to bring in customers from all over the world that come in. We train them. We provide technology. They pick up their products from us. We're also bringing in engineers, and we're hiring them from outside of the state and bringing them into the state. And what that has done now, we have over 100 people, I think, in Morton. And now recently I was acquired by Hexagon, and now I'm investing into new technologies and startups. And that's kind of how these things work. Is you want companies to build up, grow up, sell, reinvest, and continue to hire people in.
Do you have any concerns with the acquisition that the company might move?
Absolutely not. One of the major reasons why they, besides hiring me, was because of where we were located, because they see us as having great resources, being in the state of Illinois, and not having to compete against what's going on in Detroit and Silicon Valley.
What are the biggest challenges to you operating your business here?
The biggest challenge is, again, if I needed to access massive amounts of capital, there would be a restriction in Central Illinois because there just isn't a big VC environment, right? And we know that, and that's fine. So that hasn't restricted me, and nor do I need that anyway. The biggest challenge is, one is, you know, traveling out of a small airport. For me, when I'm traveling all over the world constantly, just adds another layer of a few more hours in my travel day.
But or if there's, really and if there's a delay, then you're kind of stranded.
Then I'm driving from Chicago or sleeping overnight in the airport. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I wonder, as we talk, I mean, we've had such a conversation about the role that technology is playing in our lives. And I'm thinking particularly recent conversations about privacy and when we're thinking about Facebook or Google. But I wanted to ask you on your thoughts on the role you see autonomous stuff playing, not just in terms of pushing the envelope in terms of innovation, but in making sure it actually makes people's lives better. I wonder how often you think about that when you're thinking about the technology that you're creating.
Sure. I mean, I think about that a lot. So our primary job is to help others move towards autonomous driving faster. But, you know, behind the scenes, what I'm thinking about is I have a 7-year-old disabled child who has a disability, and I'm thinking about how he is going to get from point A to point B. I think about my relatives who are aging, and I think about all the students who can't afford a car and they're living in cities. And how are they going to get from point A to point B? So there's a lot more than just developing the technology. It's really changing the way that we are transporting ourselves from point A to point B.
Do you feel like, would you wish there was more nuance in that conversation for people who aren't in technology to think about? And do you think maybe we just don't really think about technology in our lives until something bad happens or it doesn't work?
I think most people are just adopting technology as it's thrown at them and not thinking anything about it, to be honest. So that's how the cell phones and all the apps come to us. We just see something cool and we're like, cool, it makes my life easier in some way or more convenient, and we take it. But there are plenty of other people who think about what it's really doing to the industry and to mankind.
And so is there a better way consumers should be thinking about this?
It's going to be like any other technology. It's going to make our lives, we're going to be able to relax. It's going to make it more convenient for us to get point A to point B. Instead of driving being the distraction, we will just be able to, you know, play with our technology as we're being transported.
And the time frame for when you think you see this happening?
I think it's happening now. There's an evolution happening in the industry where, you know, you go from cruise control to adaptive cruise control to adaptive cruise control and lane centering. So you're almost highway autopilot at that time. And now we're about to go through a phase of massive deployment, especially in urban areas.
Bobby Hambrick is the founder and CEO of Autonomous Stuff. They're based in Morton, Illinois. He's been speaking to us at our studios in Urbana. Bobby, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for our Facebook page to like us. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stShow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.